are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 26, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of Public Policy and Economics at Stony Brook University, Stephanie Kelton, on how can we pay for all this? And modern monetary theory. Also on the program today, repeal and replace dies again. But it's not dead yet. And next up, tax cuts for the rich. But be quiet about that. Be quiet about that last part. Meanwhile, Republicans introduced the Dreamers Bill, known as the Tear Families Apart Act of 2017. New studies show Wisconsin voter ID law kept at least 17,000 voters from voting. And lock them up. At least six White House advisors used private emails. Oh, my God. Start the hearings. New travel ban, more or less same as the old ban, appears to get SCOTUS sanction, at least for the time being. Puerto Rico may see some help. North Korea asserts Trump has declared war on them. And Alabama about to elect a lunatic. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. Now, the idea behind having Stephanie Kelton on, and she was on this program back in 2012. And if you remember, you can easily search our archives on the app and find that interview. You can search it other places as well. We're going to try not to be too redundant with the interview, but much of what we've seen, and last night there was a debate between Lindsey Graham and that creepy guy Cassidy and Bernie Sanders and Klobuchar from Minnesota. And the debate was ostensibly between the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act and the Affordable Care Act itself and the concept of Medicare for all. The big question, the reason why some people feel like Medicare for all is a fantasy, is because of the cost. The big issue that we're going to be dealing with over the next couple of weeks, maybe months, will be tax cuts for the rich. Now, oddly enough, the repeal and replace bill, Graham Cassidy, cuts $1 trillion from Medicaid as of the year 2026, 10 years out. And just coincidentally, the tax plan being floated around by Republicans and promoted by Donald Trump cuts $1 trillion worth of taxes, 50% of which go to the top 1% in this country. Here is Jake Tapper talking to Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, reminding him of what Steve Mnuchin had said about their tax plans. It's not all going to go to the rich.
To roll out a tax plan on Wednesday, Axios is reporting that the plan would cut the tax rate paid by the wealthy Americans from almost 40% to about 35%, as well as making dramatic reductions on taxes on big businesses, small businesses. When you were selected as Treasury Secretary, you made a very specific promise. It was quickly dubbed the Mnuchin Rule. Take a listen.
Any reductions we have in upper income taxes will be offset by less deductions so that there will be no tax, absolute tax cut for the upper class.
Can you reaffirm that pledge that there will be, quote, no absolute tax cut for the upper class? Is the Mnuchin rule still in effect?
I did say that, and I just want to clarify. It was never a promise or it was never a pledge. What it was and it is still, it was what the president's objective was.
Hey, what happened?
It was aspirational. You know, like around the office when I say it's payday, that doesn't mean I'm going to pay you. It means it's a day that I hope you get paid.
I certainly hope I don't have STDs. I always put a rider in my, when I'm purchasing a wife, I say, yeah, I mean, I would really like to think that I don't have herpes.
It's that really.
If I do give you herpes, I'll offset it with a government subsidized vacation.
I love the fact that he said, I did say that after being played the videotape of him saying that.
I'd just like to confirm that video you played of me is absolutely accurate. It literally did happen. But, you know, it's like someone staying in their homes with a mortgage I've sold them. I'd like to think they could stay in.
Here's the dilemma the Republicans are going to have on this tax bill. Their agenda is to cut taxes for the wealthy, despite the fact of the Steve Mnuchin rule, which has now been amended. They want to cut at least $500 billion from the tax bills of the top 1% in this country. The top 1%. They know in this environment, they cannot say that. They can't even sell the idea of trickle-down economics anymore. It has failed miserably in Kansas. We talked about Arthur Laffer, who's now a joke by anybody who has any sense of what's going on in this country. They know they can't sell it unless they pretend it's not tax cuts for the rich. And so they've got a real problem. Steve Mnuchin not helping that problem by putting a massive asterisk on his Mnuchin rule. In fact, one that covers out, blots out the word rule and Mnuchin. So they've got a big problem, but this is why we're going to want to talk to Stephanie Kelton about this, because the real question is how do you deal with questions of the deficit when the deficit may not matter? And why might not the deficit matter? And why, in fact, can we pay for things even if we don't have the money today? We'll get to that when we get to Stephanie Kelton. But first, let me tell you, you spend a third of your life in your sheets. Are they taking care of you the way they should be? Introducing brooklinen.com, high-quality sheets and bedding at a price that won't keep you up at night. Founded in April 2014, Brooklinen offers simple, beautiful home essentials without the luxury price. Fastest-growing bedding brand in the world. I slept on a set last night, the gray pinstripe ones. And now we get like huge pads so that Saul doesn't pee on them. And he did not pee last night. People love these products. Their sheets have over 12,000 five-star reviews. Plus, they have versatile colors and patterns that complement any decor. This is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to have these sheets today. Believe me. I'm telling you, honestly. I love my Brooklinen sheets.
I can attest, you do rave about them.
I had one set of sheets that had little sheep on them, and I had those for 20 years. And when they ripped, because after 20 years, your sheets just rip. You don't have to do anything to rip them. They just rip. I have been searching around for sheets that I love, and now I've found them. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident you're going to love their new sheets. They offer a 60-day, or I should say 60-night, risk-free satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There's no reasons not to give the sheets a try. Only way to get $20 off and free shipping, use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's Brook, B-R-O-O-K, Linen, LINEN.com, promo code MAJORITY. These are the best sheets ever. All right, quick break. When we come back, Stephanie Kelton. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Public Policy and Economics at Stony Brook University, Stephanie Kelton. Welcome to the program, Stephanie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, okay. We're speaking, I guess, a couple of days after a major modern monetary theory conference. We are speaking sort of, I guess, on one of the days that the repeal and replace has died. It may die again soon. And we're ramping up for a major attempt to cut the taxes of wealthy people in this country. So I thought it would be a great time to have you back on the program. You were last on, I guess, really 4 or 5 years ago now, I think it was. And I want you to, I mean, in a nutshell, I don't want to cover too much of the ground that we covered before, but, you know, for people who don't know what modern monetary theory is, explain to them what it is, but let's start with Bretton Woods in 1971 and the change that happened then.
Okay, sure. So Bretton Woods is a place in New Hampshire where an important meeting took place after World War II to talk about how to restructure the international monetary system to provide some stability after the war. And what came out of that meeting was a decision to fix countries' exchange rates. In other words, a way to tie their currencies all together and keep the prices at which currencies trade one for the other at a fixed rate. So 44 countries come together and 43 of them agree to fix the value of their currencies to the US dollar. And then the US, being the 44th country, agrees to convert its currency, the dollar, into gold at a fixed price. And so it was a form of a gold standard monetary system.
And the idea being that this way we can have a sense of what things are going to cost. I mean, things aren't going to be change wildly in price from day to day, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, especially important, they thought, after the war, when countries were going to need to rebuild their economies, especially those that were most war-torn, and that this would give them some, you know, certainty about exactly how much things were going to cost, because they were going to be buying a lot of things that were produced here in the U.S. This is back in the day when the U.S. ran trade surpluses, and we were producing a lot of capital equipment and other sorts of things for the rest of the world while they, you know, repaired their economies after the war. And so this gave them a sense of certainty about exactly how much things were going to cost.
So the world operated under this system for about 25 years, and then what happened?
Yeah, we were on and off gold standard for much of our history, as were other countries. You always go off of the gold standard, though, when you have a crisis. And so the U.S. went off the gold standard during World War One, and again during World War Two, and then in the early 1970s, President Nixon announced that he was taking the U.S. off the gold standard and putting us on what's known as just a purely flexible floating exchange rate. So now the value of the dollar floats against most other countries' currencies, except those that choose to fix their currency to the dollar. So we have a floating rate currency. And why that matters is that it opens up policy space that you don't have when you're on a gold standard. If you've got a monetary system that's tied to something that's finite, that there's only a limited amount of, then you play by a different set of rules than you do when you move to a monetary system, a type of arrangement where there's much more flexibility. And it gives you a lot more flexibility in the policy space as well.
And that's why when we were facing a crisis where we needed more money, we would go off the gold standard.
Well, yeah. And I would even maybe say it a little differently. It's not, I wouldn't maybe say we needed more money, but we needed to be able to spend big. And you couldn't do that if you had a system that was tied to something finite. You got to take off the handcuffs. So we took off the golden handcuffs.
And why did Nixon decide to do this? Why was there a push to do this in the early 70s?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, and some are sort of geopolitical. I mean, it became contentious, different countries, because of the implications for trade. And if your exchange rate can't adjust, to allow a country that's running persistent trade surpluses and have that country's currency get weaker and weaker to help make their goods. If a country's running persistent trade surpluses, then, you know, the other countries in the world are running these big trade deficits and they go, hey, that's not fair. Your country's currency is too cheap. You ought to allow your country, your currency to appreciate, get stronger so that your goods aren't so cheap and give us a shot. And so there were big fights that took place. There were inflation implications, but mostly it had to do with trade imbalances.
Okay, so now we found ourselves in a new era where we're untethered from gold. And modern monetary theory, if I'm not mistaken, argues that, or I guess implicit in it, is that we haven't quite adjusted the way that we perceive money and the way that our fiscal policy hasn't quite adjusted to this new reality.
I think that's exactly right. I think that behaviorally, we and policymakers and even many academics and, you know, political pundits, they're still trapped in this framework, this mental state of mind where money is a real thing. And so you'll hear people like Hillary Clinton during the campaign, and she'd say things like, you have to find the money. You've got to go where the money is, and you need to find the money. Well, that sort of suggests that we're lifting couch cushions and poking around for, you know, coins or something, that there's money that's quote, there somewhere, and you have to go and get it. And it's almost as if we think it's under the ground, and we've got to dig it up, you know, that we haven't quite made the connection to what a modern money really is all about.
Well, okay. So once we're untethered from a commodity, essentially, like gold, I guess, mm-hmm. That has a finite, of which there's a finite amount of, money is not really paper dollars per se, right? Money is, what is money?
Well, money in the modern era we shouldn't be thinking of it as a physical thing. So take, for example, the decision last week, right, in the Senate. Your listeners probably heard about this. The Senate voted to dump a huge sum of money into the military budget, mm-hmm. Far more than even the White House was requesting, and they voted to spend $700 billion on the military. Okay.
Right. I think they wanted $54 billion more, and the Senate gave them like $80
billion more. Yeah, they said, no, that's not it. Take more. And then in addition to that, they authorized the production of something like 94 new F-3 jets, you know, two dozen more than the Pentagon had requested. So it was just like, you know, take $700 billion. We'll give you more than you even asked for. And, you know, 89 senators stood up and voted for this legislation. Now, where did they get the money to do that? And the answer is they didn't get it from anywhere. The money will be created as a result of the vote. So it's the congressional authorization to spend that triggers a whole bunch of payments that are now going to be made out of the Treasury's account to sellers in the defense and contracting industry and so forth and so on. So where does that money come from? Ben Bernanke has been pretty candid about this. Now, he was the Fed chair before Janet Yellen, and he was asked in a sit-down interview with Scott Pelley, hey, is that taxpayer money the government is spending? And Bernanke's response, I'll give you the exact quote, he said, it's not taxpayer money. He said, these banks have accounts at the Fed, and when we spend money, we just change the numbers up in their accounts. Wow, you know, that was pretty candid. And so what he's saying is the government gives us instructions and they tell us we're going to spend money on X, Y, and Z. And our job is to go out and make those payments on behalf of the federal government. So we change numbers in balance sheet. We change numbers in someone's account up. You spend another, you know, $40 billion on something, we put the $40 billion in someone's account. It's not a physical transfer of cash. It's an electronic spreadsheet entry.
How is it different from credit? I mean, how is that concept different from me going to, the Gap and buying a new shirt and mm-hmm. saying, like, here's a piece of plastic. I'm
right.
paying you with that plastic. How is that different? How is
but
it different from credit? Right. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not giving
yeah.
them
so,
anything. I'm just
yeah, yeah.
here.
So,
here's this.
So
look at my plastic.
It's different. it's different because what you're doing is you're telling the Gap that Visa is intervening on your behalf, that Visa is going to handle the payment. And so what you're showing them is something that they trust, the Visa, the MasterCard, whatever the case may be. And the Gap is saying, okay, that's cool. We know that we're going to get paid, so we're going to let you walk out the door without tackling you when you leave with your shirt. And so, but you haven't paid for the shirt at that point. You've substituted a third-party obligation, and you said they're going to handle the payment. But they're not finished with you, right? Because at some point you're going to go to the mailbox and you're going to find a little envelope in there, and Visa's come knocking at your door. And what does Visa want? They want you to pay for the shirt. And so, you know, you're probably going to pull out a checkbook. Maybe you're going to have an electronic payment. You'll go to your computer and take care of it. But maybe let's say you write a check. And so, you know, you sit down, you fill out your check, you put it in the mail. Visa opens up the envelope, and there's a check from Sam Seder. I say, oh, this is great. Look at that beautiful signature. We're just going to hang on to this check because that's all we need from Sam. No, Visa's going to cash the check. And what happens when Visa cashes the check is they get government money. That's the end form of payment. It's the final means of payment. So when the government is paying for the military spending we just talked about, it's already making a final payment. It's paying with its own dollars. So you can't do that, and I can't do that. And poor Puerto Rico can't do that because they can't muster up dollars out of thin air. The federal government of the United States is different. It's given unto itself the exclusive right to create the U.S. dollar. There's not an entity on earth other than the federal government who can create the dollars. That's where they come from, and that's why they can never run out, and it's why they get to play by a different set of rules. They're not like a household or private business.
So when we're told that if they cut taxes, according to the plan that that the president is promoting and that Paul Ryan is promoting, it will add $1 trillion to the deficit. When we are told if we go and provide Medicare for all, or even Medicare for the people who you know are 65 and older, at one point it's going to blow a hole in our deficit, in our debt. Why is that not like I owe this money to Visa?
Okay, so, well, a couple of things. Let's make sure, just so that all the people who are listening are clear on what that means to say that there's a deficit. So if the government, let's take the first example, where we have these huge tax cuts, most of which go to those who are already at the very top of the income ladder. And government says, we're not going to collect as much money from you as we used to. We're going to take less away from you. Okay, that's the tax cut. And so as a result, the government's books are going to show, you know, fewer credits coming into them, and the non-government, the private sector, is going to keep more dollars. So we say, let's say the government deficit increases. Another way to say that is to say the private sector surplus increases. They get to keep more of their dollars, right? So what's the risk in that? What is the government on the hook for? And the answer is nothing. Now, in the U.S. right now, if the government, do the other example, Medicare or something, increases payments on something, and that results in a bigger deficit. So let's say the government spends 100 into the economy, but it only taxes back 90. Okay, we label that a deficit. We say the government has run a deficit, but it has left $10 in the economy that wasn't there before. Now, the result of running the deficit right now in the U.S. is Congress requires itself to borrow. So whenever I run a deficit, I force myself to sell treasury bonds, and that's called borrowing. And whenever I sell bonds, the debt increases. Okay, so what happens is I spend 100 into the economy, I collect 90 back out in taxes, I left behind 10, and now I wave around this thing called a U.S. bond, government bond. Now the bond offers interest. So somebody out there in the economy is sitting there holding 10 U.S. dollars that don't pay any interest. The government says, who wants to buy the bond? And, you know, people say, I do. I want that interest-bearing thing because, you know, so I'm going to make money off of that. And so they swap their $10 for the U.S. Treasury. Now they have a bond. And so we say the government is now, quote, in debt, right?
Right.
And every single Treasury bond that's out there being held is somebody's asset. But it's on the liability side for the government. So we say the government is, quote, in debt, But we often forget that all of those Treasury bonds are the assets that are being held in pensions and other portfolios all throughout the economy. So I guess the question you're asking is, does that matter? Or is that like using a credit card? When you use your credit card, maybe you charge it up and you get to a point where you go to the mailbox and the bill is there and you don't have the cash. You can't pay. Right. Your account doesn't have enough money. You're in trouble. Hey, you may miss a payment. And then your credit score may go down. Then you may have trouble getting credit and borrowing later on in life. That doesn't happen to the federal government of the United States, because all it's doing is promising to do what? To take that Treasury bond back from you in the future and swap it for dollars again. Can that be risky? Can it ever find itself in a situation where it can't make a payment in U.S. dollars? Of course not, because we just said the federal government has the exclusive right to create the dollar. Can never run out or be forced to miss a payment. It can't turn into Greece. We don't depend on China. I mean, all of those things that we hear all the time are just fundamentally incorrect.
Okay, so we've walked through that dynamic where the United States has the ability to always to provide dollars for people who call in their so-called debts. But what about, I mean, we don't hear this quite as much as we did 5 years ago when we were talking about this, or even 6 or 7 years ago. Well, I was told by now we would be Weimar Germany, and that when I go down to get my sandwich, it's going to cost me $75 to buy, like, you know, a loaf of bread or something. Why didn't that happen? And why won't it happen if we behave or have the understanding that you are suggesting?
Okay, so, well, why wouldn't something like that happen, what you're describing, a hyperinflationary scenario? I think what a lot of people were worried about 4 or 5 years ago, 6 maybe years ago, was what the Fed was doing. Not so much what Congress was doing, although maybe some of that, because deficits got really big in the wake of the financial crisis during the recession. I mean, we had trillion-dollar deficits, which are more than double the normal size of the public sector deficit. So maybe people were concerned about the size of the deficit causing inflation. But there was also a lot of concern, you remember, about what the Fed was doing, all that quantitative easing, and people were calling Bernanke Helicopter Ben, and there were cartoons of money being dropped from the sky, and this was all supposed to lead to massive inflation. So I guess there are a couple of ways to think about it. One is, what causes inflation in the economy? The U.S. just has not experienced any kind of serious inflation since really the 1970s. And globally, what countries are struggling with right now is not any kind of inflationary pressure, but all across the world, governments are struggling to just keep inflation in positive territory. In other words, to avoid deflation. And so inflation remains very, very low in spite of the fact that governments ran these big deficits and you had all these central banks doing quantitative easing and other sorts of things, printing money, so to speak. So if we can't get inflation up, and central bankers have been very frustrated, you know, at their inability to get inflation up to their 2% target even, then one question is, maybe it's just not that easy to generate inflation. I mean, if it were that easy to do, surely we would have been successful by now. I mean, $3.5 trillion increase in the Fed's balance sheet and so forth. So I don't think it's all that easy. And I think inflation is one of these phenomena that economists do not understand very well. The last time we had significant inflation in the U.S., again, was in the 70s, and we had oil price shocks.
Yes.
So, you know, that kind of thing is easier to understand. But just running an economy at full employment, taking advantage of the policy space you have and trying to use the government's budget to achieve broader objectives in the economy, like full employment, isn't going to get you an inflation problem.
And so the idea, I mean, as I understood the fear at that time was the Fed was essentially, you know, creating money out of thin air, which is, I don't know how else you would do it, really.
Exactly.
I mean, they were creating money out of thin air, just like you would suggest that, you know, Congress created money out of thin air when they voted to raise the military budget by $80 billion. It's not like anybody went into, you know, into the bowels of the Senate and started with a pickaxe and started, you know, pulling this stuff out. And the idea is that, I mean, that fear, as I understand it, is that our monetary policy would create inflation, as opposed to sort of like the market where you have, you know, oil shocks and you have a tremendous demand that outstrips the supply, and all of a sudden people are paying more for something, and that's driving inflation. So, so if it's the case that we can't, it's extremely difficult to create inflation, or maybe impossible, unless I guess you're just not paying attention, to create inflation by simply paying, the government paying for something, by creating money out of thin air. Why do we need to sell federal government bonds? Why do we need to collect taxes? Why don't we just pay for things?
Well, I guess the first one I'll answer is, why do we need to collect taxes? Why don't we just pay for things? Who would work or produce and transfer real resources, their own labor, their own materials? You know, who would make things and sell them to government in order to get dollars if they didn't know that they needed the dollars for some reason? So in other words, what I'm saying is, the reason that the dollar is the dominant financial instrument in the U.S. economy is because it's the means by which the government spends, pays for the things it buys and collects money from people in the form of taxes. So, you know, in another country, in Japan, it's the yen. Why isn't it the dollar in Japan? Because the Japanese government makes all of its payments in yen and collects taxes in yen. If you eliminate the tax, then you eliminate the demand for the currency in the private sector. Why would people be willing to work and produce to get this worthless piece of paper or, you know, spreadsheet entry in their bank account? We've got it backwards. We think of the government as needing our money. So you always hear people talk about taxpayer money. You got to find the money. We think they need to come to us and collect dollars that they can then turn around and spend. It's exactly backwards. They've got the power of the purse. They've got the monopoly on the dollar, and it's us, the people, who are subject to a variety of taxes in our everyday life. You couldn't get, you know, from home to work without being confronted with some type of tax, whether it's, you know, putting gas in the car or stopping in for a cup of coffee. You're gonna need to pay a tax, and all of those taxes are denominated in dollars. So we need their money. They don't need ours. It's completely backwards. And why do we borrow? That's a good question.
Let me just interject one thing on that tax thing. Yeah. David Graeber tells this story quite well, I think, in his book Debt from several years ago. And how, you know, when the Roman armies would go into an area, they would introduce the currency and say, we're this has value to you because we're going to take it in taxes. So you begin to use it as an exchange because it essentially allows you, and I'm not advocating imperialism here, but it allows us to pay the dues to basically be part of this society, essentially. And it's the only thing we're taking. You know, it's not puka beads. If you go down to, you know, the all-inclusive resort, they have their own currency there because that's what they'll take as like a tax for the rum drinks you're drinking or whatever it is. And it's basically the same situation here. This is what we accept in this society. It's the dues you pay for society, and that gives it its value.
That was very well said. I should have said it that way. That was perfect.
Well, and I got that from David Graeber. But so okay. Well, so why do we issue federal government bonds?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it made sense before the Fed was doing what it's doing now. What it's doing now is paying interest on reserve balances, the accounts that banks keep at the Fed. So the Fed has this idea that it prefers to have interest rates above zero. It wants positive interest rates. And so right now it just achieves that goal by announcing the amount of interest that it's going to pay on the accounts that all these member banks keep with the Fed. So if they want interest rates at a half a percentage point, they just pay a half a percentage point on the excess reserve balances. If they want to go up to 75 basis points or 3/4%, they pay more. If they want to go to 1%, they pay 1. In the old days, they didn't do that. and they were kind of one of the few central banks that wasn't paying interest on reserves. They were using this old-fashioned technique called open market operations. I'm not going to bore listeners, but basically what it involved was buying and selling government bonds in order to add and take away reserves in order to hit their interest rate targets. So the bonds were important because they were a tool that the Fed used to conduct monetary policy. They don't need that tool anymore. They just do it directly by announcing the interest rate and changing what they pay. So the important role of government bonds is gone now. Now you say, well, are there other, do bonds play other roles? And yeah, they do. I mean, I'm sort of torn on this one. Some of my colleagues in the MMT community, the other scholars, have advocated for just stopping altogether, not issuing another U.S. Treasury ever again. Just spend the money into the economy, tax some of it back out, and leave the difference sitting there, and let the Fed pay the interest. Right now, it's Treasury who pays the interest. And that, like, fires up everybody in Washington. They're all obsessed with the line item of the budget called interest on the debt, because they think that the bigger that gets, the less room they have to spend on other things. And it drives them crazy. And so, you know, you might say, well, don't issue bonds. And then once you retire all the outstanding debt, you won't have any interest on the debt. And then you don't worry about it. I don't know. I'm not quite there yet, I think. I feel like, you know, government securities are such an important, safe asset in the global financial system that I just haven't convinced myself that it would be okay
so, in
to
other
eliminate
words,
them.
Okay. And
yeah.
So let me just, so in your mind, the bonds actually serve a different function, which has less to do with the government being able to spend, which has nothing to do with the government being able to spend, mm-hmm. but has to do with just providing a safe harbor for people in times of economic turmoil, because it is such a rock solid place. It's like, why do we need a bank? Well, because people feel comfortable if there's a big iron door there and protecting stuff.
Yeah, and you can diversify. You know, you have this risk-free asset that pays you some interest, and you're not even taking risk, which, by the way, is one of the criticisms. Why should the government be paying interest to people who hold treasuries, mostly the wealthy, you know,
right.
Who aren't even taking any risk? But, of course, there are lots of treasuries and pensions and other types of places, too. So that's kind of where I come down sort of struggling to pick a side.
Okay. Now, you've got to go teach in a few minutes, yeah. other people aside from us. But let me ask you this. There's two questions that I, you know, and maybe we need to do this again as an amendment to this. But who needs to understand this? And in whose interest is it to not understand this? In other words, do we really, because like I find myself, like I've been aware of this theory and it makes sense to me, but I find that even as I talk about this stuff on a day-to-day basis, it's like, that's not an argument I want to have to reintroduce every time I talk about this stuff. But who really needs to understand it? I mean, if the government one new government came in and understood this theory and just behaved in that manner and nothing happened for long enough, would that be enough, right? Because everybody's kicked the can down the road and fixed the debt, yeah. and all these groups that I heard about 3 years ago, they've all seemed to have disappeared. No one's worried about the deficit or the debt anymore. Whose interest is it in not understanding this, and who really at the end of the day needs to understand it for us to actually provide our citizens with what we want?
Well, I think, you know, there are probably a lot of people in whose interest it is to have, you know, this not well understood. And I'll just pick one, and that would be, you know, the Pete Pearson Institute. And so there are people out there like this billionaire guy who founded the Peterson Institute, but then also has under that umbrella literally hundreds of other organizations. You mentioned Fix the Debt. That's one of his. That are running around trying to persuade voters, you know, people, that the U.S. has an unsustainable fiscal situation, that we're going broke, that Social Security and Medicare are the biggest drivers of the debt crisis, and that we've got to make changes today. You said kick the can. Their whole purpose is to say we can't afford to wait. They create a sense of urgency, and so the picture has to be really dire, and they haven't given up. I mean, you may not hear as much about it today, you know, now that the Republicans control right. everything, but they are still after Social Security, they're still after Medicare, and the debt crisis, they believe, is the surest way to get there. You persuade people that there is no alternative, and you make cuts today to deal with this phony crisis.
I mean, but the thing is, like, are they going to enrich themselves if we don't have Social Security?
Oh, sure. I mean, as major employers all across the country contributing 6.2% of payroll to Social Security and Medicare and addition, you know, this, yeah, this is a huge form of a tax cut for them. Absolutely.
Because and they can't adopt the posture of like, we could just pay for Social Security. And you don't have to tax us anymore because, of course, we need taxes to maintain the value of our currency.
Right, right. No, they'd rather see it privatized and then stop their contribution altogether.
And we should also say it's also taxation is another way also of making sure that you have wealth, you know, some you don't have obscene wealth inequality.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. Well, okay. I know you've got to run, and I still have more questions, but I think this is a lot for people to digest today. So the bottom line is, when we hear that we can't afford things like Medicare for All, the reality is we can. We just have to decide that we want to make that political choice.
That's right. Congress just has to authorize the spending, just like it did with $700 billion for the military last week.
Stephanie Kelton. Where can people get more information on modern monetary theory if they want to learn more about this?
Well, they could go to Amazon and Google those words. There are books available there. There's a website, a blog called New Economic Perspectives. They could check that out.
Great. We'll link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I did it.
How
I got her out by 12:45. So let me, you know,
how are we gonna afford that?
She had to go teach because she's a professor and other people need to know about this stuff. But the bottom line here, and I hope this was we weren't going too quickly. I wanted to sort of just lay this out here. I can tell you that in 2011, I think it was, maybe it was 2010. I would regularly go on. Oh, gosh, now I've forgotten his name. Who was that dude whose show I used to go onto on MSNBC who had the big explosion onto, and he's now off of MS. He was a finance reporter, and Jenks friends with him. What? No, not Dobbs. It was
Jenks,
I can't remember
lot.
That guy.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
The guy with the curly hair.
Dylan Radigan.
So I was a regular on Dylan Radigan's show, and at one point they had David Stockman on. And David Stockman was the budget director for Ronald Reagan, I believe. And he was, I don't know if he was on Pete Peterson's payroll. If I had to bet, I would say it was. But I would also say he was a little bit odd. And he, at that time, I can't remember what something he was saying. He was coming on PIMCO, the biggest holder of bonds in the U.S., one of the biggest hedge funds or the number two at PIMCO has just sold their bonds, and we're going to have a massive crash in the summer, and it's going to be because of these bonds, and we're going to go bankrupt, and this country is going to go bankrupt. And he was 100% wrong. We had a guy on this program called Bush and Chains, who we don't hear from that much anymore, who was insisting we needed to get gold because our currency was going to, had a problem with the idea that deficits don't matter.
If only he could do economics as well as he does music.
Indeed.
Shame.
And this has been the rallying cry for people who want to cut things like Social Security and whatnot, because we do need taxes, but we don't need them to fund the government. We need them to be confiscatory. We need them so that we don't have massive wealth inequality. And we need them so that we maintain the value of our currency. And And this is also why we need, to my libertarian friends, the monopolization of force by our government to put you in a cage, as I have been told, has been said to me by libertarians, to put you in a cage if you don't pay taxes. That's correct. That's why your money has value. Because if somebody wasn't going to come to you and say, we're going to put you in a cage if you don't pay your taxes, then the dollars wouldn't really have any value. Why would they?
You are a madman and very evil.
We cannot and so quantify freedom. We need taxes to provide value for our money. We need taxes to keep wealth inequality in check. Our taxes are too low. Remember, for the greater part of the biggest expansion in our economy in this country, in fact, for the entirety of that, every dollar you made over what would be in today's dollars, somewhere around $3 million, was taxed anywhere from a 70 to a 90% rate. Every dollar above that. We had estate taxes to make sure that wealth was not concentrated in small amount of hands, small number of hands. And maybe in the context of Trump, it would be a small hands. I work that in. But the reality is that we can spend on Medicaid, on Medicare for all. We can spend. We can spend as much as the government wants to spend.
Lindsay was all over that last night.
And
when the beginning it would be, you know, actually we're going to take care of you just as well. It's just going to be better spent and people who are local to you care about you better and all that nonsense is amazing in the context of American history that you could say that with a straight face. But then after the debunks happened and Bernie said, what's the most popular, you know, we'll play it later. Medicare is the most popular health care program in the country. Then it just came down to Lindsey Graham, you know, we're all going to die, basically. Just the version of there's going to be a major economic collapse and you could have a Medicaid for all card, but it'll just be a card and no care.
That's right.
And this is all the argument she's talking about.
And the reality is that we're just still stuck on this idea. And really, I think the reason why we're stuck on this is partly tradition. But I think part of it is that there have been hundreds of millions of dollars spent. I mean, if you don't know the name Pete Peterson, maybe we should just do a show about Pete Peterson.
Yeah.
He was Nixon's, I think, Treasury Secretary. And then he went on to make a ton of cash at a hedge fund, I believe it was. And this guy has made it his life's work. And I can tell you this, that you have the amount of people that you have read about, heard about, seen on television, reporters who have gone to functions put on by the Pete Peterson Foundation in some form or another would blow your mind. I would say the majority of people, if you listen to a normal amount of NPR, cable television, network television, read articles in the paper, the majority of people that you consume, or the majority of the information you consume, those people, the majority of those people have in some way attended, been paid, got a fellowship from Pete Peterson Foundation. It is stunning. It's stunning. I'm not saying they're all, you know, shilling for Pete Peterson, but they just spread that money around.
It's ironically a very easy way to make a living and a great social safety net for pontificators.
Right. It's pretty amazing.
It's one of the easiest hustles in the world.
So, and then, you know, the dilemma that I didn't get into, and this is for another day with Stephanie Kelton, maybe we can talk to some other MMT people about this, is, you know, the one that I have every day where, and sometimes I think you've probably heard me say, like, I'll say, this is going to add to the deficit, but that really doesn't matter, but that is an issue that we hear Republicans talk about. I will drop it in here or there, because the other dilemma is, like, who do you need to have believe this? The concept is hard to wrap your mind around because of the way that we've all been taught. The way that we, it's very hard for us to conceive of money as not being what it's like in our households, not being what it's like in our checking account or in our credit card account. We don't have the ability to create our own money. And, you know, the only thing you could probably do is, like, we used to hand out to Mila when she was a kid tickets for her to be able to watch TV. And you could create, I guess, in your own household, a system like that where it's like, I can make as many tickets as I want. Then I'm going to tax you to take some back. And maybe I'll give you another way of earning tickets. You can earn tickets by doing some work around here. And you regulate the number of tickets that she has. And I can create as many as I want. And if I see that she's watching too much TV, I pull back on the tickets. I take a tax. I don't know if that's that works out in the same fashion, but it's an important concept to understand. And I still haven't quite worked out who it is needs to understand this within the context of our government. What is the minimum number of people? Does it have to be the citizenry? Could it just be a president? Can it be a treasury secretary? Can it be a couple of senators? I mean, do they all understand it when they vote $80 billion to add to the biggest military times X in the world? Do they all need to understand modern monetary theory to make that vote? I don't know. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And folks, this show does not have the ability to print its own currency. And while I try and convince Matt and Michael that payday is an aspirational concept, not a pledge or a promise, it's an intention. And it's a hope.
You know, in some ways, when you look at what is actually given to us, the message is coming across.
It's a hope. It's a hope.
Agreed.
Yeah. And
I hope that I can literally physically survive on what you eke out for us.
There you go. So, folks, help me in my aspiration.
It's an inequality crisis. Here, get your tokens for crumbs.
By becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day will support this program. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you bonus content. We give you bonus content. What else? Well, we give you archive features and tons of stuff like that. Also, don't forget, tonight, Too Much BS is happening. That's right. The Michael Brooks Show, you can watch live on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Sam Cedar. We got to come up with a link for that.
Yep.
Majority, yep. You know what it should be? It should be like Majority Live, and that should just go right there, right, or something like that.
That's smart. Corey Pine and Matt Crisman.
Corey
Pine.
Maury Crime, Pat Crisman. I don't know. I just did one of those things. Like Norm Cosby. I didn't mean to, but it was coming
out. Oh, you
really
didn't mean to do that?
No. I did the second time. Corey Pine and
Matt Crisman.
Matt Crisman from Chapo, yes. Trap House. All right, folks. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And we'll be right back in the fun half.
Sad.